Welcome to the August 2018 edition of the Rehab Cast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox. And in this episode, we're going to have a news roundup, followed by a discussion with Dr. Doug Katz. He's former president of ACRM, and he's one of the lead authors on the new guidelines on the care of persons with disorders of consciousness. These guidelines are co-published in the archives and in the journal Neurology, published by the American Academy of Neurology. It's a multi-year work product by a team of experts around the world. And as you'll hear, all of us involved in the care of persons with DOC are hopeful that the guidelines will help advance the science as well as access to care that already exists, but patients are too often denied. First up in the news, it's high trauma season. If your rehab hospital is anything like ours at Shepherd Center, you're packed to the gills with traumas of all sorts in the summer season. But I was astounded recently by the sheer number of diving injuries on our spinal cord injury service as I rounded one weekend this summer. I stopped in on at least 5 young people who'd been injured in this way. It's a never-ending battle to get the word out that no dive is a safe dive. Now, I'm lucky enough to have a pool in my backyard here in Atlanta. Among the first things we did after moving in was tearing out the diving board. One of the interesting things, if a bit morbid, about a career in rehabilitation medicine is seeing all the new and creative ways we humans come up with to injure ourselves. Now, here's the latest one to concern me.
Electric scooters rented via apps are flooding city streets.
Let's say we want to get this one for you. So you just have to scan the QR code that is here.
QR code, yeah. Right there.
An American company called Lime has e-scooters in nearly 30 US cities and just dropped hundreds on the streets here in Paris.
And then you have to give a first push.
First kind of,
and then you're good to go.
The scooters top out at 15 miles per hour. They cost $1 to rent, 15 cents per minute to ride, and use the same lithium-ion batteries your phones and tablets do.
We raise $135 million.
$135 million Lime has raised.
In a year and a half, so it's pretty good.
That's a lot of capital being injected into this
exactly.
Market.
Are e-scooters the next new wave of traffic-related morbidity and mortality? If you're working in a big metro area where they're rolling out this summer, I bet you're starting to see some of these too. Now, here in Atlanta, we recently spotted a bird scooter rider on a major highway called the Downtown Connector. Another rider got creamed in front of the hospital right next door to us. I wrote about a rider who suffered a severe TBI that I recently treated at my hospital for CNN.com in a piece headlined, "Do Something About the Dangers of E-Scooters." Now, e-scooters are dropping into cities without any planning, any preparation, or education, and predictably, accidents are happening as unhelmeted riders interact with pedestrians on the sidewalk or the much larger motor vehicles on the roads. I do think this new transportation technology has a role to play in congested cities, but introducing them without any planning is egregiously irresponsible on the part of the tech companies that are putting them out there. The lack of planning even extends to accident liability, as medical insurers point to car insurers saying that they should pay when an insured motorist decides to rent an e-scooter. And those motor vehicle insurers are saying, hey, there's nothing about e-scooters and your car rental rider. When health and safety is on the line, it's crucial that one company's legitimate right to come up with a handy new product and money-making scheme doesn't infringe on your right to move freely in public spaces. Next up in the news roundup, from CNN, it's Escape from Mayo Clinic Neurorehabilitation. Now, I write for CNN Opinion, but that doesn't mean that I have a hand in anything else that CNN decides to do. It's a big operation, and I only have a window into a tiny sliver. Now, there's one reporting project published on August 17th that really surprised me. Perhaps dismayed is a better word. We're talking about this widely circulated story here on the Rehab Cast because it concerns Mayo's inpatient rehabilitation program.
Alyssa Gilderhuis and her family say they experienced the seemingly unthinkable In this email to police, Alyssa's mother says her 18-year-old daughter was medically kidnapped by the world-famous Mayo Clinic.
Do you think they were trying to medically kidnap you?
Yes, I completely do. Not a doubt in my mind.
This was Alyssa on Christmas Eve in 2016 with her family in Sherbourne, Minnesota. On Christmas Day, a blood vessel burst inside her brain. She had emergency surgery at the Mayo Clinic. Doctors gave her a 2% chance of surviving.
How did those neurosurgeons do?
Fantastic.
Phenomenal.
They saved her life.
After a month, she moved to the rehabilitation unit at Mayo with new doctors.
When you had opinions or thoughts about Alyssa's care, did they listen to you?
No.
I don't feel they did at all.
Did they seem annoyed with you?
Yes.
Because we were parents, not the doctors, because they knew everything and we didn't.
The tension eventually exploded, and Mayo kicked Alyssa's mother out of the hospital after they say she interrupted a meeting.
Now you can read the two-part story on CNN under the headline, Escape from the Mayo Clinic. Teen accuses world-famous hospital of medical kidnapping. It comes complete with video the family shot getting their 18-year-old daughter out of Mayo under a ruse, saying that she needed to go downstairs to see her grandmother, who was too feeble to come up to the floor. Once they reeled her out of the front of the hospital with Mayo's attendants behind, they got her into the family vehicle and sped away. Mayo then called police to report a patient abduction. The story is the result of necessarily one-sided reporting, with CNN having full access to the distressed family of a patient that disagreed with the recommendations of continued inpatient rehab from their Mayo Clinic rehab team. Now, despite CNN's decision to go forward with the reporting, Mayo decided it couldn't discuss the case in detail with CNN, even with a signed release from the patient, as in Mayo's ethical opinion, discussing those details wouldn't be in hers or her family's best interests. From a neurorehabilitation practitioner's perspective, the situation Mayo faced isn't all that unusual, even though how far it spiraled out of control, fortunately, is quite unusual. Mayo was treating an 18-year-old recovering from a brain aneurysm who lacked capacity. That's, of course, quite typical. But the patient's next of kin, the patient's biological mother, in charge of her medical decisions for her, was someone that Mayo came to believe it could not entrust with her care either. Now, since this story is reported only from the mother's perspective, the reader isn't privy to the behaviors that Mayo witnessed that so worried them. Strangely, we're told in the story, also from the parent's perspective, that the hospital sought to obtain guardianship itself over the patient, which really isn't how it works. The crucial corroborating evidence that the patient shouldn't have been forcibly kept in the hospital against her mother's will is the fact that when the family took the daughter to an ER in a neighboring state, that ER thought that she was fine to go home. Now, you and I know this doesn't grok with anything we know in medicine. The decision of an emergency room that a person is medically stable enough to go home has little, if anything, to do with the recommendations of specialists that neurorehabilitation is in the best interest of that patient for a better long-term outcome. Journalists also spoke with the captain of investigations of the Rochester, Minnesota Police Department, who said he did not investigate the patient abduction that Mayo reported as an abduction because, in his view, the patient and her parents both wanted her out of there. This decision is also irrelevant to the earlier decision-making inside the hospital because the courts had not made a decision yet on the patient's guardianship. A crime could only have occurred if someone else had custody over the patient, and that guardian didn't agree with her mother taking her home. But there was no such guardian. Once police determined that the quote-unquote abducted individual wasn't in imminent harm and was agreeable to the people providing her assistance, it's true, there's nothing for police to do. Now, Mayo's sophisticated crisis response includes its own reporter questioning Mayo's executive dean for practice.
Mayo Clinic continues its response to the story CNN published earlier this week titled Escape from Mayo Clinic. Mayo has called that story inaccurate, incomplete, and irresponsible. And joining me is Mayo's executive dean of practice, Dr. Mike Harper, to discuss more of Mayo's response. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Harper. Why is Mayo Clinic taking such a strong stance?
Because we want our patients, our employees, and the public to know the truth. We think that this story had a lot of inaccuracies in it, and there was a lot of data that we shared with CNN that wasn't included or considered in their story. We initially did not want that necessarily to become public because we wanted to protect the patient, and we still want to protect the patient. But we feel that our side of the story really wasn't properly represented in the CNN report.
Did Mayo Clinic deny a request from the family to transfer the patient to a different facility?
No, we did not. We would have been happy to transfer the patient if the request came to transfer them to a facility that had the capabilities to take care of them, particularly a rehab center with all the necessary resources to make the patient able to move to a more independent living state.
And did Mayo Clinic staff remove the patient's mother from the hospital?
Yes, we did. We did that for very good reasons. We don't do that very often, and we only do it for certain reasons. And in this particular case, the reason was because the patient's mother was being disruptive and showing aggressive behavior, both verbally and physically, to our staff. So not only are we charged with protecting the safety of our patients, but we're charged with protecting the safety of our staff.
Dr. Harper, one point of discussion is this question of guardianship. Did Mayo Clinic seek to be appointed as a guardian or make decisions for that patient?
No, we were not seeking guardianship on our behalf. We were seeking to have an outside responsible person chosen as a guardian who could make reasonable decisions on the patient's behalf, because the patient really was impaired neurologically and couldn't make those decisions independently for themselves.
So what can we all learn from this bizarre tale? It's certainly further reinforcement of just how bad things can get once trust is lost between families and care teams in the hospital, but this isn't news to anybody in medicine. Now, since this particular situation is all out in the public now, I would be interested to see Mayo comment on the one question I do have about the affair, whether there was another blood family member they could have worked with in lieu of the patient's mother, and whether that person's demands differed any from the mother's demands. The most important statement we heard in Mayo's response is their flat-out denial that Mayo denied a request to transfer the patient to another rehab program. Mayo says the family made no such request, and I find that fascinating. And here's a late-breaking update from the Mayo Clinic's Jennifer Plumbo, who got back to me just before we rolled out the show on the question I posed above about whether another blood relative was in play that Mayo could have or should have worked with. It turns out there was. Here's Mayo Clinic's verbatim response to my query. "Hello, Dr. Vox. I apologize for the delay in responding. We have been inundated, as you might imagine. The patient's biological father was here and making decisions for the patient when the mother was not present. The patient herself was an adult, but was a vulnerable adult due to being hospitalized and having a significant neurological insult. She was nonverbal and had been evaluated by psychiatry just a couple of days prior, and they deemed that she was not able to make complex decisions for herself. Nonetheless, while in our care, the patient never requested a transfer. Her biological father was here making decisions for her, and he was not requesting a transfer. The mother had been removed from the facility due to her escalating verbal and physical behavior toward our staff, despite repeated warnings and a behavior plan that she agreed to and then broke, and not acting in the patient's best interest. Mayo requested the courts appoint someone as guardian and decide who should make decisions for the patient. The mother had an attorney friend reach out to Mayo Clinic, but she said she was the family's advocate and not their legal representative. She also was not representing the biological father, who was on site making decisions at that time. The advocate requested a transfer sometime that week, but then the mother and stepfather removed the patient from the hospital the following day, thus not allowing sufficient time for Mayo to act on the letter anyway. The against medical advice form was only found by Mayo Clinic after the patient had been removed from the hospital by her mother and stepfather. The biological father's criminal history was unknown to Mayo Clinic, and no one from the family raised that as a concern at the time. He had the same parental rights as the mother. We received an allegation of the mother's past abuse of the patient and reported that to authorities, along with two other reports that we made to authorities regarding actions of the mother. In short, we were very concerned for this patient and her safety and her well-being, and did everything possible to try to address the situation and get help from the courts. So there you have it, straight from the Mayo Clinic, further crucial details that were not adequately reflected in the story. In addition, Minnesota Public Radio has done some of its own investigation surrounding this story, and they report that, independent of Mayo, NPR News found court documents that a Martin County judge ordered the mother's five younger children removed from her care in July 2018 after allegations were raised of neglect, physical, and emotional abuse. The mother tested positive for methamphetamines and amphetamines when a county official visited her home in Sherburn to investigate child abuse reports. So those court records were available in the month prior to the publication of this news story, and perhaps should have further put the brakes on the publication. Investigative journalism has a role to play in healthcare, but it is a qualitatively different sort of act to go digging around apparent controversies in medical care versus, say, a political scandal. One party in any given healthcare complaint faces both legal and ethical prohibitions against dissecting the matter in public. This situation does not mean that reporters can't ever report on such conflicts, but it raises the bar for how they corroborate those claims and how exactly they package the tale of woe to be featured. In this case, I do think CNN could have done better, and I told them so. JAMA published a study this month on the TBI suicide link, a matter well known in rehabilitation circles. The authors utilized Denmark's excellent registries to look at everyone 10 years and older living in Denmark in 1980, some 7.4 million people, and follow them through death or leaving Denmark, or the year 2014, whichever came first. Among the 34,529 recorded suicides among that group of over 7 million people, 10.2% had prior medical contact for TBI, 7.8% with mild TBI, 0.5% had a skull fracture without a documented TBI, and 1.9% had a severe TBI history. TBI of any severity compared with those of no diagnosis of TBI was linked to an almost twofold increased risk of suicide. An accompanying editorialist asks, how exactly do TBIs increase suicide risk? What are the substrates and processes that causally link TBI, a highly heterogeneous condition, to a singular catastrophic outcome? The answers are undoubtedly multifactorial and complex. How true, and work that continues. Over in the journal Stroke, we have more results from Medtronic's sister study, this time a secondary endpoint analysis showing that intrathecal baclofen therapy is lowering pain and improving quality of life for patients with post-stroke spasticity in direct comparison to oral medications. The study reports on post-stroke patients with Ashworth scale 3 or higher spasticity in the lower extremities, comparing 31 patients who got ITB to 29 who received conventional treatment including medications. The study is titled Effect of Intrathecal Baclofen on Pain and Quality of Life in Post-Stroke Spasticity, a randomized trial. Check it out. And now it's time for our featured interview. Joining me now on the Rehab Cast is Douglas Katz. Doug is a professor of neurology at Boston University, and he's the director of the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Program at Braintree Rehabilitation Hospital. You'll recognize his name from the cover of the textbook, Brain Injury Medicine. Dr. Katz recently served as president of the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine. He's one of the lead authors on a slate of new guideline recommendations for the care of persons in a disorder of consciousness, coming from a group of esteemed researchers and clinicians convened by the American Academy of Neurology, ACRM, and the National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. Dr. Katz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
This is an effort of a whole lot of folks across the world, really. You've worked on these guidelines as it's another multi-society type task force involving both the American Academy of Neurology and the ACRM. Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of it? About how long ago did the idea start? How difficult was it to start up this process? Just give us a little bit of window about the beginning and what did you feel was the need at that time?
Well, sure. And I'll also mention that the National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research was also a collaborator on this project, along with the American Academy of Neurology and American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine. So this project was something that was initiated by the American Academy of Neurology to update a practice guideline that was put out some 23 years ago on what was called, what we do still call, the persistent vegetative state. And this was meant to be an update of that. It's been quite some time since the previous guideline, and it was something that the American Academy of Neurology felt was needed to be done. And given the kind of explosion of research in this area, particularly after another paper that was published with Dr. Giacino, Joseph Giacino is the lead author, in 2002, the case definition of the minimally conscious state. Since that time, there's been a lot of research that has helped clarify the diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment of persons with disorders of consciousness. So the time was ripe. It's been 23 years since the last one. This effort was really about a seven-year effort. Again, Dr. Giacino, Joseph Giacino, is one of the leads on this effort, and he pulled together an expert panel from around the world, as you mentioned, to update these guidelines.
Now, there are a number of headlines in the guidelines. I suppose one of perhaps the most important is jettisoning altogether the term permanent when it comes to vegetative state for both traumatic and non-traumatic. There had been debate for some time with use of persistent versus permanent, but that term hung out there for some time for people 12 months post-traumatic or 3 months post non-traumatic. In these guidelines, it's recommended to get rid of that altogether and go to chronic. Tell us a little bit about the thinking of chronic vegetative state and why that is important.
When the guideline was published 23 years ago on the persistent vegetative state, they introduced the term permanent vegetative state based on the guidelines prognosis findings at that time. But even at that time, as you mentioned, there was some controversy because there were a few published exceptions of people who had recovered consciousness after the limit for permanency at that time, 1 year for a traumatic brain injury, 3 months for non-traumatic brain injury. So there was some controversy whether the term permanent, which has the implications that there's no chance of recovery, was really appropriate even at that time. So one of the findings of this new guideline is that there is evidence that there can be later recovery of persons with prolonged unconsciousness that we refer to as vegetative state or an unresponsive wakefulness state, and certainly patients who show signs of minimally conscious state, which was newly defined even after the previous guideline, that suggests that the term permanence is inappropriate. So we have come to consensus on substituting the term chronic vegetative state with a designation of the duration of the impairment of consciousness, the disorder of consciousness, along with the term chronic instead of permanent.
Now, to get into we're not going to go through each and every one of the recommendations, but I want to hit some of the highlights and get your thinking about those. To start out with, the guidelines do recommend, there's a lot of what I would say are level B and level C recommendations in these guidelines. Level C are kind of relatively endorsed things that clinicians may do, appears valid, evidence is growing for them. Level B is something that you should do. And level A, of course, you really must do. On the level B, to start out with right at the beginning, is that clinicians should refer patients with DOC who have achieved medical stability enough to do so, should send those patients into settings that are staffed by multidisciplinary rehab teams with specialized training to optimize diagnostic evaluation, prognostication, and subsequent management, including effective medical monitoring and rehabilitative care. I'm particularly pleased to see this recommendation, since it's something we do here at Shepherd Center, you do in your practice at Braintree, and I know that in order to implement guidelines as complicated as these, that's a very complex task. It is interdisciplinary. There's not a lot of settings that match it. I think it's important to recognize that expertise, unfortunately, does only reside in certain places in our healthcare system. Hopefully the guidelines will spread this knowledge. What are your thoughts about that initial recommendation?
Yeah, I think it is important. The evidence and the consensus of the experts supported it fairly strongly, as you point out, a B-level recommendation. I think we all feel, as you know, in treating these patients, that this is a disorder that presents a lot of difficulties in diagnosis. It requires knowledge of the disorder and the literature to be able to formulate and explain prognosis, and some of the treatment strategies that are used to treat the neurologic condition that causes a disorder of consciousness, to try and perhaps improve recovery, as well as treating medical problems that are common and recognizing the medical problems that are common with this disorder, as well as the specialized rehabilitative care to keep a patient in as best a health, nutritional condition, and avoiding complications as well as possible, are important and really require a certain amount of training, expertise, and experience in order to do it properly and to do it to the maximum benefit of patients.
Now to bring in another article briefly that you did not write, but Dr. Joseph Fins did, and James Burnett, about the ethical and policy considerations in DOC. This kind of leads into that to a certain extent. They did point out in their paper that at the same time as we're starting to recognize MCS, new electrophysiological techniques are becoming available to us to detect covert consciousness. At the same time as we're making these advances and recognizing the importance of these programs and picking up early on medical complications and so forth that prohibit later emergence, patients are getting less and less access to these programs and facilities. It's a really disheartening dichotomy there between the science and the actual medical practice. This is something that everyone is in rehabilitation has dealt with, perhaps to some extent, plus or less, on a variety of diagnoses. But with DOC in particular, it's been rather dramatic. What are your thoughts about that, and hopes for what the guidelines may do in that arena?
Well, I think it's always been a challenge to try and get patients with severe brain injury and prolonged disorders of consciousness to facilities that have the experience and expertise to diagnose and treat them. You know, it's generally a challenge throughout healthcare to try and get the the best expertise and the best level of care for all sorts of patients. I think the one of the roles of a guideline like this is to present the evidence, the scientific evidence in the literature, as well as the consensus of the experts in such a guideline, to try and move support for treatment in the direction that we think is most advantageous for patients and their families, and hopefully to allow the support and any changes in policy that might be necessary to facilitate having patients in the facilities that can best care for them. So I think the role of evidence-based guidelines in medicine in general is to both guide practitioners and families to seek the proper medical care, and hopefully to sort of guide others responsible in supporting that care, payers, any kind of government policy to try and facilitate the best care and treatment for patients with any disorder, and in this case, patients with severe brain injury with prolonged disorders of consciousness.
Now, I don't think it'll be too much of a surprise for most of the physiatrists out there who have kind of exposure as part of our training to the brain injury rehabilitation population, that that neurobehavioral assessments are increasingly the standard, and hopefully the rest of the broader medical community will start to understand this problem of the diagnostic error rate. Even the world's kind of most skilled neurologist or physiatrist in a bedside exam is really handicapped with that one snapshot to really declare, is this patient vegetative or minimally conscious, or sometimes even better, that you really do need to do kind of more of a structured assessment. And many of us think a repeated assessment too, which the guidelines advance as level C, the idea of serial assessments. I know you do that in your program, and we do in ours. The guidelines endorse attempting to arouse your patient and recognize that people may be perform better at some times of day than another. Certainly diagnosing other medical conditions that could be and treating those that could be clouding your assessment of the patient's consciousness, all fairly straightforward stuff. The guidelines also do start to look at the variety of electrophysiological measures that are starting to become available and explored in a variety of centers. And we've seen a real explosion of research over the past couple of decades, in particular in these. Most all of them are still level C, something that programs need to be aware of, perhaps explore in individual cases and so forth. Of the electrophysiological techniques, what do you feel are some of the most promising?
Well, the guideline looked at a number of electrophysiologic techniques, including electroencephalograms, EEG, and doing various types of analyses and quantitative analyses of EEG recordings. There are also papers that look at evoked potentials and stimulating either a somatosensory stimulation, or, and there are, of course, other types with auditory visual stimulation, but particularly somatosensory stimulation, and looking at responses there. There are papers that have come out looking at various other perturbations and how it might affect electrophysiologic responses. From presentation of stimuli to transcranial magnetic stimulation and other sorts of stimulators. And then there's actually looking at EMG responses as a more sensitive way of looking at a motor response that may not be as apparent to the visual eye, but had also come out as techniques that might enhance our detection of responses.
Yeah, I think the EMG analysis, surface EMG, is particularly nice. It's something a little bit more certainly straightforward. A lot of physiatrists already have a background in it. Something that we have explored here at Shepherd and are attempting to kind of integrate more regularly into our program. But it's definitely an exciting area, and I think that the guidelines, given how well they discuss them and lay out some of the different options, will probably increase the uptick of clinicians who are treating these patients to start to implement one or more of these types of analyses into their programs.
Right, and I think we should emphasize these electrophysiologic techniques, and then we may speak also about the functional imaging techniques that have been a large part of the investigations are by this guideline and, you know, based on the evidence that we have so far, they're meant to help support diagnoses when diagnosis is ambiguous based on the neurobehavioral exam alone. There's no one test yet that will supersede the behavioral exam. These are meant as to help sort of supplement diagnostic diagnostic accuracy, and they're not meant as something that's going to be better than the neurobehavioral exam or completely replace the neurobehavioral exam, and vice versa. These tests themselves, whether it's functional neuroimaging or neurophysiologic tests, in and of themselves alone are not going to help make the diagnosis. But together, they may improve accuracy of diagnosis along with neurobehavioral testing.
Now, on that imaging spectrum that you mentioned, I don't know if controversial is the term or not, but certainly one thing that's going to get people's attention is this recommendation for SPECT scanning 1 to 2 months post-injury to assist in prognostication regarding 12-month recovery of consciousness and degree of disability and recovery of patients in traumatic vegetative state. That is endorsed at level B as something that clinicians should start to do. I'll tell you, I've not done a SPECT scan on one of my patients yet. I have, because of these guidelines, discussed it with nuclear medicine over there at our partner hospital, Piedmont. I've gotten pricing on it as well and run the protocol by them. And it's something that I'm willing to consider. It's certainly the evidence is one that can be debated as well. So what are your thoughts about that? I know the guideline publications, not everybody on the guidelines committee might necessarily agree with every point that ultimately the group decides on. But what's your thinking about SPECT scanning, this level B recommendation in particular? Should we start to explore it and maybe start to order this test?
Well, I don't have a definitive answer. I do want to clarify one thing, though, just to make sure that we're switching the question from diagnosis to prognosis. So now, previously we were talking about using these tests to supplement neurobehavioral exams to help clarify diagnoses that may be ambiguous in terms of level of consciousness. The recommendation regarding SPECT was based on evidence that a normal SPECT scan at 1 to 2 months, along with some other evidence from other types of testing, including P300 evoked potentials and the like, were possibly associated with an increased likelihood of recovery of consciousness or a more favorable outcome. And you know, was felt based on this, you know, very rigorous process of using the evidence to come up with recommendations that the evidence in that particular case of a SPECT scan at 1 to 2 months was strong enough to reach a level B. You know, again, I think with any kind of recommendations, it's always up to the clinicians, along with discussion with patient and family, to sort of make the final decisions. Although it was a a strong recommendation in terms of how it can help with prognosis. It's still going to be up to the clinician to make their decision based on the recommendation and their own interpretation of its usefulness and availability of the test. I thought it was an important paper and an important recommendation, and it is something I will consider going forward in formulating prognosis in some of my patients. I haven't fully decided yet in general how I'm going to introduce it into my practice. But looking at other recommendations, I will take a close look at it. Everyone will have to make their own decision, and then further, you know, evidence as it comes out may change how we view this recommendation in the future.
So it's fascinating to see that guidelines influence everyone. The guidelines aren't necessarily just for the totally uninitiated in the field too, but people who treat a lot of this population like yourself on the guidelines and me as well can be influenced by them. I think it's probably a good process as well. It shows that that this really is a worthwhile activity up and down the full spectrum. But yes, prognostication, extremely important topic for families, and really part of the most difficult process of what we deal with in DOC rehabilitation. The papers and the ethical paper as well are really point out. Certainly we discussed the misdiagnosis issue at the baseline. There's a big difference between vegetative, minimally conscious, and your chances for emerging. But there's a lot of active withdrawal of care early on, perhaps in the acute setting, or maybe some other levels of care before people enter into DOC programs that in all cases may not necessarily be appropriate, and that's something that the guidelines may ultimately start to influence as well. It depends on the decision making of that family, so long as they are properly educated. But there's upwards of 70% of the withdrawal of care really motivated, it seems like, on perhaps a prognostication that may be too severe.
Right, and an inaccurate diagnosis and prognosis can lead to inappropriate care decisions and poor health outcomes and withdrawal of care, as you pointed out, and misdiagnosis can result, and prognosis that may not be appropriately conveyed or accurate can result in premature, inappropriate treatment withdrawal and failure to recommend beneficial rehabilitative treatments, and possibly a worse outcome. So one of one of the strong recommendations of this guideline is to avoid giving an inappropriately poor or negative prognosis, particularly early on when some decisions are made to withdraw care that may lead to a worse outcome or death. And it's important that I think one of the important roles of this guideline is to point out to those clinicians that are seeing patients early on not to give an overly negative prognosis, to look at some of the outcomes that are pointed out in this guideline. For instance, some 20% of those with traumatic disorders of consciousness can regain functional independence even between 2 and 5 years post-injury, and take that into account when conveying prognosis and helping families to make decisions at those critical early times. I think it is definitely an important recommendation here to avoid what some people consider the kind of conventional wisdom of a uniformly poor prognosis for patients who have very severe brain injuries who are anticipated to have prolonged disorder of consciousness. The evidence shows that uniformly poor prognosis is just not true, although there is a range of possible outcomes. Certainly, a significant proportion will have outcomes that families and patients themselves may find acceptable, favorable, and as I said, the evidence shows that with traumatic prolonged disorders of consciousness, some one-fifth of those patients actually achieve functional independence.
Now, on the treatment front, I don't think it's going to be breaking news for the vast majority of our listeners that the guidelines endorse the use of amantadine at least between 4 and 16 weeks post-injury. Unfortunately, I guess at this time, the only medication with enough evidence behind it for this guideline. I imagine most people are using that medication as tolerated at this point, though it may further spread the knowledge about the utility of amantadine a bit further. Looking at kind of treatment recommendations that perhaps are a little bit more tricky to implement, is the strong endorsement of attempting to treat pain in this population, and how that interplays with the need to keep folks aroused and engaged in therapy, and how do we interpret pain in VS and MCS is a matter of some debate, and there's some scales for that. But there are ethical implications to this as well, as there seems to be in most of the things that we deal with surrounding DOC. But treating pain on one level, in terms of just a scheduled background medication, could certainly interfere with some of your assessments. So there's a need to kind of integrate that into your program, and kind of when you do kind of holidays on it and doses and so forth. What are your thoughts about whether the guidelines, how it deals with pain? Are you concerned about over-treatment of pain in the population? Certainly, I feel that in my own case, I've received a number of patients who have been on scheduled opioid pain medications that as we've gone down on, I've seen an improvement in my patients. So, certainly there's some art to this.
Yeah, so it's difficult. It's tricky because in a patient with a disorder of consciousness, it's hard to sometimes interpret responses to pain, and I think the main thrust of the guideline is that to recognize that accurate assessment of pain and suffering in patients in individuals with disorders of consciousness is limited. In the challenge to accurately diagnose pain, and we can't just assume, if you think a patient is completely unconscious, that they're not experiencing pain or suffering at some level, because we can't always have full confidence in the diagnosis of complete unconsciousness. Period. There have been unconsciousness, and the period of time that they're in a disorder of consciousness, there may be awareness of pain that we cannot detect. I think that's sort of the main focus, is to not assume that there's no pain, to treat as if there is the potential to experience pain. But as with any treatment that has side effects that may affect responsiveness, the well-being of the patient because of side effects, there has to be a balance between sort of the benefit of treating the pain and avoiding side effects that may be detrimental or may cloud assessment. I think the main point is, don't assume if you think a patient may be unconscious or minimally conscious that they are not necessarily experiencing pain and suffering.
Well, Dr. Katz, these are very high-yield papers. I would certainly encourage any clinician who ever comes into contact with this patient population to spend some time with these papers. They're not overly long, and you can learn quite a lot. And I think that they're going to be incredibly important to the field. Now, they've been co-published in the Green Journal Neurology and the Archives at the same time. That's going to help get them out a bit. What else are the society is going to be doing to make everyone understand that these guidelines now exist and to refer to them?
Well, we will have a symposium presentation, actually a double symposium presentation led by Dr. Giacino and a number of us who participated in the guideline at the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine, ACRM, meeting in Dallas this year at the end of September and into the early October. So we will be summarizing the findings of the guidelines and hopefully having some discussion at those symposia. And I anticipate that we will be presenting these at other national and international meetings coming up in the near future.
Excellent. I think it's going to, you know, be a good thing for the field and is going to generate a lot of discussion. Hopefully we'll continue to encourage more research for this long underserved patient population. And I truly hope to start to see some policy implications from this paper. I think it can be really used as a tool for advocacy for the patient population.
Yes, I agree, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the guideline with you today and answer questions for our audience.
Again, thank you so much, Dr. Katz, for joining us on the RehabCast. And listeners, you heard him mention the upcoming annual conference, which will feature a double symposium on these new DOC guidelines. There are still spaces available if you can make it to Dallas this year. Thanks for tuning in to the August 2018 edition of the RehabCast. Please join us again next month.
This podcast is brought to you by ACRM, the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine. Don't miss their annual conference coming to Dallas, September 30th through October 2nd, the largest rehabilitation research event in the world, and it's interdisciplinary. Visit acrm.org.